In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking with author and member of the Climate Psychology Alliance, Sally Weintraub. We discuss underlying mental processes ranging from narcissistic entitlement to profound caring. These form the individual and collective conflicts that society is wrestling with in responding to the climate and ecological crisis. Thanks to all members and subscribers for supporting this work. There is a great deal more interviews to record and to process, and your support is vital. Sally is also quoted in my book Cop Out that is available now for pre-order. I discuss the failure of governments to act in the last three decades of climate conferences that have passed by and highlight the changing themes that are dominating the current rounds of climate talks. This year will also mark the first COP where Professor Salim al-Haq will not be present. Salim died last month, leaving a legacy of clear thinking, relentless action, and calling out the people, governments, and corporations pushing us all into catastrophe. He has featured in many of my interviews and has been a significant influence and inspiration in my work over the last decade. Thanks again for listening. Sally, it's fantastic to see you. Thank you for taking the time. Can we start by defining what we mean by psychological impasse in the context of this discussion?
Well, I've been thinking recently about impasse, which, if you think about it, is you're making progress down a road, and I'm talking about psychological progress towards a better place, acting more for the good, acting more responsibly. And then I'm conceiving of impasse as something that blocks you, that puts up barriers in your way to stymie the progress. And, you know, I've talked about this a bit, and in some work I recently did on impasse, I found myself going back to the period after Copenhagen, the COP talk at Copenhagen, the setting of a limit, a limitation, a real limit of 1.5 degrees. And, you know, we're in it right now. We're crossing that limit right now. And so we're talking about sort of 2012, 13, 14, that kind of period, when a lot of people really got it. In fact, world governments agreed to it verbally anyway, and there was a limit. We had a sort of a surge of optimism, struggle. I'd mentioned that I attended this remarkable conference in London with this weird name, the Radical Emissions Reductions Conference. And I'll come back to that word, radical. And it was mostly online from around the world. And it had experts from every area, shipping, energy, you name it, agriculture, you name it. And people were saying one after the other for two solid days, it can be done. We can decarbonize. We can rapidly reduce our emissions. It was remarkable, and it made me realize, actually, that I hadn't really, even although steeped in climate, the subject, I hadn't really believed it could be done. And then I thought that's the effect of culture, massive effect of culture. So radical, I'll just fill that in, because Kevin Anderson was there, and he made this point, which was so relevant. He said, we're in a radical situation now, because if we act, it means change. And if we don't act, it means change, a very different sort of change. And of course, he got it. It was absolutely profoundly true what he said. We can have change for the better or change for the worse, but we cannot avoid change now. And that was back then. And I thought to myself, that's profoundly true, but will people get it? Will they actually be able to get it in time? Anyway, that was the scenario. And then what did we see? We saw this massive assault by, I think, fueled by the fossil fuel industry and vested interests, the governments that support them, and so on and so forth, the media, the culture, everything. And what did it do? It gave us ClimateGate. It gave us relentless greenwashing. It gave us very perverse accounting, and it spread disavowal in the media right across the board. Now, that is impasse. That's the move to progress and a force of reaction that, and it's perverse. I mean by perverse, truth bending. It's a perverse reaction that seeks to stop the progress in its tracks. And tragically, I mean, really tragically, it's been very effective. And so you've seen impasse expressing itself in those ways. You know, they say, oh, the issue of climate, you know, it's really about security. And from their point of view, they mean it, because they know that the ordinary human impulse is not just destructive. It's actually on the side of life. You know, we saw increased securitization. We saw the beginnings of the law actually shifting so that it made it more difficult to protest. They were on the case. This is part of impasse as well. So maybe I'll start there. That's the force of impasse, but there's more to say about it. That's one kind of impasse.
As we, and I just use the sort of individualist or collective, but we're at this point, and you could say that we're at this impasse where it is a moment that urgent change is required, but you look one way, it needs to be changed for the good, and the other way is obfuscation from the fossil fuel industry, and you get stuck because it's not clear. You use the term extended drool, and it can almost allows you to continue this sort of business as usual, despite what you can see with your own eyes, what you know is incoming information.
Well, the extended drool, it's a concept from Alton Krenak, who is an indigenous South American leader. I think he's Brazilian, and I'm a psychoanalyst. You know, it's a very psychoanalytic concept, really. I'll put it this way in my terms, but I take it, that's his phrase. By the late 70s, you had James Hansen speaking to Congress in the States saying, you know, climate change is real. We've got to do something about it. It became public knowledge. It was known before, but it became public knowledge. And the world was waking up to it. And you had Donella Meadows writing Limits to Growth. It was a great flourishing of reality-based thinking and a move to progress, real progress. And the progress involved the need to accept limits, profoundly accept limits, that limits to our greed, to what we can take from the earth, provided by legal systems, by curtailment. That's what we were waking up to. So we would either respond by making change, which would lead to things like the Radical Emissions Conference, or we would engage in, and this is where my analytic understanding or point of view comes in more, engage in ways to make limits disappear with what's called omnipotent thinking. It means that, like God, God creates the world. We can just create an alternative reality. The Donella Meadows framework was saying the economy sits inside a wider ecology. We have to take that into account. The predominant economic system said, no, no, we're not having that. We just get rid of that. And so we abolish limits. Now, the drool. So the response to that kind of thinking, which I describe in my last book as narcissistic entitlement to use omnipotent magical thinking and to have whatever we want and to we abolish limits. In terms of the drool, you can take the analogy, and so did Krenak, of the baby at the breast takes his gums off the nipple and sort of looks around and has this, of course, it's a metaphorical moment, looks around and suddenly sees the world, that the world is not just the mother there solely for baby. The mother has a reality quite separate. In other words, to transpose it to what I was talking about before, humankind suddenly sees that the earth is far bigger and complex, and it's there in its own right. Reality is there in its own right. And we need a radically different relationship to reality if we're going to survive. This is a shocking moment. So the drool is that the baby clamps back on the breast and says, not now. Okay, just not now. And somehow sort of suspends time. And time comes into it too, because it sort of murders real time. And so we can just go back into this nostalgia that we don't really need to change. We don't really need to face the reality. We can we can carry on as we were. But the tragedy is that while we're doing that, we're causing untold damage in the real world.
You use the term narcissistic entitlement, and I perceive that as a way where you can look at your own motives in life. There's another term you use, which is lively entitlement, and these two are sort of like the plus and minus in a way. Is that a fair description?
Yes, I think it is. And I don't think we're going to sort this problem out with climate unless we collectively face both those kind of feelings of entitlement inside us. We need, because one's on the side actually of death, narcissistic entitlement, because it knows no limits. I'll say a bit more about it in a minute. Actually heads one towards death, ultimately. And lively entitlement is entitlement to a relationship with reality. And unless we actually work on both those inside us, because they ultimately feel like and express themselves as very different kinds of willpower, and they're at war with each other. This is old psychologically. It's not just from our modern era. It's part of who we are. I think it's vital that we learn to recognize these things inside ourselves, that starting with the narcissistic side of things. So I talk about being an exception and exceptionalism, and I kind of define it, broadly speaking, as being in the grip of narcissistic entitlement. So I'm entitled to see myself in as an idealized version, a super version of myself. I'm entitled to have whatever I can have without limit. And this is crucial, I'm also entitled not to have to feel that this is immoral. I'm entitled to have ways and means of psychologically getting rid of my feelings of guilt and conflict. And this has been amplified in our era since the 80s, I would say, with the coming into power of neoliberal economics and government. So that sort of narcissistic entitlement on the one side. And then you have lively entitlement. I'm entitled to struggle to be human, i.e. humane. I'm entitled to struggle to have a relationship with reality. I'm entitled to have conditions that actually support life. I'm entitled to feel responsible. And I'm entitled to my inner struggles with myself. All of that is what makes me human. And I'm entitled to understand and face limits. So you're talking about a struggle between these two different parts of the self and the group.
Both of them relate very nicely to care and uncare, which are terms that you use with explicit meaning. Can you talk a tiny bit about that? Because I think that feeds us into how we navigate this.
These things are psychological attitudes, positions that struggle. The one is on the side of uncare, and the other one, very crudely speaking, the other one is on the side of taking care. Now, what my argument is that what we've seen, I particularly focus on the neoliberal age, although my analysis is actually deeper down than that. It's more psychological, because it's not, these issues haven't just arisen with neoliberalism, but neoliberalism has exacerbated them. It's sort of turbocharged them. So the culture of uncare is how I describe neoliberal culture. It's language framing, it's education, it's the media, it's advertising, it's across the board. And in particular, it's the culture that gets into our social groups. That's where it's fought out. And so this culture of uncare does two things. It takes that duality inside us, and it boosts our inner narcissistically entitled exception. Yes, you are entitled to have whatever you like. You're entitled to, you know, limitless acquisitions, and it boosts the inner exception. And it also attacks the part of us that cares. A culture of care is the reverse. It boosts our capacity to care, and it curtails our uncaring side.
Can I just comment, because I think there's something you mentioned in your book, which everyone should read, is the psychological roots of the climate crisis. You emphasize that the uncare side requires a hell of a lot of investment to get it into our psyche, if you like. And there are these linkages. We have think tanks, which actually produce intellectual sludge, but these think tanks that influence policy, but they're also very closely linked to things like the fossil fuel industry. They're very closely linked to our mainstream media in the UK. So that you start to see these linkages into how people start to ingest this stuff and repeat the memes that come through. I just wanted to emphasize that point, is that it requires a lot of investment to make us uncare. It's not like it's a natural thing for us.
I think that's absolutely, and it's a really important point, you know, because part of the culture of uncare has driven and drives every day this message. We are basically selfish. That's all we are. We're scrambling to the top, and it's a very patriarchal kind of message, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, when you look at it, this has to be in an ongoing way massively funded, because there is a basic knowledge that people do care. And in order to get them not to care, you've got to message them relentlessly. So, yes, thank you for bringing that out.
Yeah, they wouldn't invest so much without the same small groups getting so much back. And it's a machine for which we're the kind of fuel for it in a way.
Absolutely. And also, thank you for bringing out that ultimately any economic system requires a culture to bring it about and to massage people into cooperating with the economic system. And that's what we've seen happen.
Can you talk a little bit about care, but also lead into frameworks of care, which is a term you used earlier, which I think is really key to this?
Yes, I give quite a lot of examples, and I like using myself as an example, because if you use anybody else, it immediately makes people feel guilty. And so, you know, I'm struggling with my own guilt and the uncaring side of myself, and how difficult it is to live within the current economic arrangements. I mean, it's a daily life of going to the shop, what you buy, looking at all this horrible packaging, you know, where things come from, et cetera, et cetera. How does one live a life? It's hard to be caring in our current situation. Also, there are little voices, some of them internalized from group discussions. And I go into all this and use myself as an example of how I fail, and I keep failing to be caring enough, you know. So because I think, and I'm not just talking about myself, I recognize that I'm trying to give voice to something that's beyond me. So it's a big struggle to care.
A term you used earlier on was frameworks of care, and this seems to be a key part of all of this. Can you elaborate on that a little?
Yes, I think part of the culture of uncare has been to convince us that we're all atomized individuals. It's broken up our sense of community, and also that means collective struggle. And so we might be left thinking, oh dear, this is an individual fight I've got on my hands between different warring sides of myself. And we won't see sufficiently that actually one's capacity to care is not just an individual thing. We do vary in how caring we are or uncaring we are, but we're vastly helped if we have frameworks in place that support our capacity to care. And by frameworks, I mean all sorts of things. I mean a culture that values a moral code and a sense of responsibility. I mean the law. I mean social mores and rituals, a lot of which have changed in the last era, that help us to stay in contact with reality, help us face change, help us face our own limitations and death, things like that. I mean, I'll give you an example, can I?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, because I'm old, you know, I've watched things really change in this era, so that children before, say in the 60s or 70s, a birthday party would involve a child inviting 6, 7 of their friends from school and sitting around a table, eating and playing games. Okay, that would be the birthday party. Now, Nowadays, well, I don't have to spell it out. The entire class has to be invited. The entire class has to not only have a party with party bags, but it also has to send a cake to school for everybody to eat. You know, it's a lot of cake. And then there has to be professional entertainers and so on and so forth. Now, the entitlement that's built up in that is enormous. Okay, but I want to say something else about it. What you miss in this new form of birthday party is any struggle with, oh, I never got invited to so-and-so's birthday party. What does that mean? You don't have to struggle. You don't have to struggle with, is the group being nasty to me? Why am I being left out? Maybe it's got something to do with me. You don't have to have any of that struggle. It's building up a sort of a fake world that doesn't equip you to face reality. And also, somehow or other, it's all just a mega celebration. And it doesn't quite so much have the other side, particularly for the parents of, it's sad that my little Johnny is now 6, not 5. There's no mourning. There's no fitting in. There's no mourning. So we've seen massive changes in the use of ritual. So what I'm saying is care and one's capacity to care, which by which I mean to not only love and be loved, but to face reality, you need a framework, a massive framework, cultural framework around it to support it and to enable it to flourish. That's what I mean.
As we see the situation worsen and we see consequences now on a wider global scale, it's that Antarctica, 10,000 estimated emperor penguins died, the babies, because they weren't old enough to survive. You know, we see these things, the irreversible collapse of the ice sheet in West Antarctica is unstoppable now. And it impacts us locally. It impacts us in our own communities. We're seeing the storms hitting the Europe right now, but they're global. They're everywhere. If you've been burying your guilt about your lifestyle, for example, how do you summon the courage to face it? How do you open that dialogue with yourself? Because it seems like an important part of this.
There are two things I would say. The first one is, you know, you talk about the penguins, the baby penguins. And in one way, I'm glad you brought that up, because it also comes to the second way that I use impasse. The first way I talked about impasse, which is this aggressive, destructive blocking of, you know, movement to address things. But the problem is that it has consequences. It leads to another kind of impasse, which is that it becomes more and more difficult to work things through and to accept reality. You know, it becomes more and more, we all become more and more traumatized. And then it becomes harder and harder to face reality. So if I might say, I heard the thing about the baby penguins early one morning. I hadn't got up yet. My reaction to that was to sit bolt upright. And my thought was, I've got to make it to the bathroom because I'm going to vomit. Okay? And I can feel myself emotional now. I registered at the time. I'm not able to process this. That's my reaction to this. It's just too awful. And somehow, I don't know what, but I feel worse about the animals, even, you know. Anyway, that was my reaction. Now, you could say, well, that's it, you know. It was bodily, but I wasn't able to mentally or emotionally process it. I can feel now, actually, a few months later, talking to you and bringing it back, I can feel something tearful around the edge of my eyes. You know, there's something coming through now. But I really was unable to process it. Now, I was in an impasse. I'm still in an impasse. This is what we're dealing with now. And I find it, I was thinking this morning before talking to you, I find it really something that the difficulty it is to actually get on the map, and even at COP talks, that we are in a mental health crisis. We are all struggling to face reality, and it gets harder and harder to face. And it might be part of a cultural onslaught that refuses to recognize that we have minds, that we're human, that we're fragile, you know, and that there is a limit to how much we can bear, you know. And if we don't face this, I think we're going to be in big trouble. You know, people, some people are feeling very hopeless. Or I heard a kid who said, I don't want to live in a world that doesn't care about animals and people. You know, these are very serious signs of the trouble that we're in. And we're in because we haven't acted. And I'm sticking to emissions right now. I know the problem is much wider, but it all depends on changing our sense of narcissistic entitlement to just exploit everything we see. You know, we're in a lot of troubles. And I can take up the second part of this issue. How do we bear our own participation? Because by our, I'm talking about largely about us in the global north who are driving the impact. And first of all, I think it really helps to pay great attention to one's emissions and take responsibility for them and do one's absolute level best to not fly, to reduce one's emissions and so on. I mean, I think that really does help one. But the other thing is that it seems to me that wishful thinking, but it is moving in that direction. I want to just talk about a potential law of ecocide. And I want to talk about its mental health implications, because obviously a law of ecocide means that, unlike now, where nobody in a corporation bears any individual responsibility for what happens, a law of ecocide would actually bring people back into the picture and say, if you cause irreparable damage or significant damage and you are the CEO of a company, you will be personally liable. Now, I find that it helps to imagine a framework of a law of ecocide, almost as a framework of care to help us in our dilemmas with our own guilt and responsibility, because it helps us to have a sense of proportion. You know, we can start to see that, yes, we're a bit guilty, we are a bit guilty, but we're not as guilty as that. And the reason I say that is because human beings, you know, my professional experience tells me, and my personal experience, human beings find it really hard to manage guilt. They veer from feeling nothing to do with me on the one hand, you know, like, oh, my little bit of emissions is so tiny as to not make any difference. That's the big get out clause, isn't it? On the one hand, so nothing to do with me on the one hand, to feeling crippling guilt on the other. And also it's complicated, you know, because anyway, so I think a law of ecocide would help us just to manage how guilty we are.
And that would fit in back into this idea of a framework of care in a way, on a very broad scale.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, I did record a segment with Polly Higgins years ago, and she actually said, can you turn the camera back on? And she made a statement to the camera about ecocide as an expression of care, and that it required courage to act in courage. She made this relationship between the word courage, the heart, and caring. And it's quite funny that you mentioned it there.
Can I say something about Polly?
Yes.
I was really touched and honored to do an interlogue with her. And it was actually about ecocide and mental health at the time, and what it brought to mind about how we manage all this and how we manage our guilt about the next generations was 2019 on the bridge during an XR rebellion demonstration then, the occupation of one of the bridges. And at that moment in the afternoon, we were there for Polly, who had died. And I looked up and I saw a mother, a middle-aged mother, holding in her arms what looked like her daughter, and they were both weeping. And it just felt to me, weeping for Polly and weeping for the situation, and it felt to me like there was a way to talk to the next generation, you know?
Yeah. And it is these sorts of things, like campaigns for ecocide, the activism. These are all expressions now of caring, despite the fact they're being demonized by the uncaring part of our society at the moment. But is there anything else you want to add? Because I think that you kind of answered my last question by using the ecocide reference.
I think that the power of the idea of frameworks of care or having systems in place, however one wants to describe it, having regulation, okay, having the law, these are all frameworks of care. I think it's very important because we need to have that embedded and funded and there for us. Because if we don't, we're more likely to come out in a protest and then all go home, still living in a framework of uncare until the next time we summon our energy to come out on another protest. The power of the framework of care is that it puts in place at a society level a way to enable our caring part to function better. And I think it's the frameworks we need to fight for.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Sally. It's been excellent to speak to you. And I hope to speak to you again.
Thanks, soon. Nick.